The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we dive right into the August 2nd, 2013 edition of The Week with the main stories. The first headline, debt-ridden Detroit files for bankruptcy. What happened? Detroit entered uncharted waters this week after it became the largest American city to file for bankruptcy, sparking what is sure to be a long legal and political battle as government leaders try to slash the $18 billion the ravaged city owes to pension funds, unions, and creditors. This is a difficult step, but the only viable option to address a problem that has been 6 decades in the making, said Michigan Governor Rick Schneider. The governor filed for Chapter 9 after Detroit's state-appointed emergency manager, Kevin Orr, failed to reach out-of-court settlements with unions, retirees, and a long list of lenders. In an attempt to block cuts in the $9 billion owed to retired workers, city pension funds sued Schneider and Orr, claiming that the state constitution barred changes in promised benefits. A state appeals court this week put that legal challenge on hold, clearing the way for a federal judge to begin reviewing the city's filing. Leaders of other financially troubled cities across the U.S. will watch the case closely. If you end up with precedent that allowed the restructuring of retirement benefits in bankruptcy court, that will make it an attractive option for cities, said bankruptcy lawyer Carol Denniston. Detroit is going to be a huge test kitchen. What the editorials said. The bankruptcy filing is the can of consequences Detroit's been kicking down the road for decades, said the Detroit News. As the population steadily shrank from 1.8 million to 700,000, businesses fled and the city's tax base shriveled. Officials did nothing but bicker, deny, and avoid. Remaining residents live in a place where, in a life or death emergency, they may as well call a hearse as an ambulance, where some 90% of murders go unsolved, and where entire neighborhoods are wastelands of abandoned buildings. Bankruptcy will bring yet more hardship, but hopefully the court will wipe away much of the accumulated debt, freeing money for restoring services. If Detroit isn't too big to fail, is any city? Said the Wall Street Journal. Many other municipalities, including Oakland, Philadelphia, and Chicago, have also dug themselves into deep holes by giving unions lavish benefits and then making ends meet by borrowing, taxing, and slashing essential services. Detroit's bankruptcy shows the party is over, as it may soon be for other cities. What the columnist said. Don't blame unions, said David Sirota in Salon.com. Detroit was killed by globalization and corporate greed. Following the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement, Michigan lost more jobs than any other state, 43,600, as car manufacturers relocated factories to lower-cost Mexico. Another 80,000 jobs went to China. The big three automakers, meanwhile, made terrible business decisions while getting tax breaks from desperate city officials. Detroit serves as a cautionary tale of what happens when large corporations are allowed to dictate the economic future of an entire city. Actually, it was 51 years of continuous Democratic rule that did in Detroit, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Knowing they were safe in power, the city's liberal leaders grew fat on corruption while failing to provide their citizens with basic services, from good schools to safe streets. Fed up with dysfunction, huge numbers of Detroit citizens packed up and left, taking their businesses, their innovation, and their tax dollars with them. Public unions must also share in the blame, said John Stossel in RealClearPolitics.com. They refuse to let the city trim its bloated workforce, which has twice as many municipal employers per capita as comparable cities. Detroit's water and sewer department still employs a horseshoer, even though it keeps no horses. You're ignoring the race factor, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Following the 1967 race riots, vast numbers of white Detroiters fled the city and moved to the suburbs. That left Detroit with mostly very poor black people who can't afford to pay much tax and who require high levels of government services. Today, Motown teeters close to anarchy, and it's hard to imagine any plausible way to pull the city out of its death spiral. The second of the main stories is on Britain's future king. Celebrations were held around the world this week to mark the eagerly awaited birth of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge's son, George Alexander Lewis, the third in line to the British throne. The prince was delivered after 12 hours of labor, weighing 8 pounds and 6 ounces. He appeared before the world the next day, swaddled in blankets, as Prince William and his wife, Kate Middleton, left a London hospital. "It's very special," said William to the waiting reporters. "He's got more hair than me, and his mother's looks, thankfully." Prince George's birth was marked with a series of gun salutes in London, while an official bulletin announcing the news was displayed at Buckingham Palace. The British economy was expected to enjoy a $380 million baby bump through the consumption of celebratory spending and a tourism surge. "For America, too, the great Kate wait is finally over," said Nick Bryant in BBC.com. For weeks, local networks throughout the U.S. replaced their thumping news anthems with regal-sounding music, while newspapers speculated endlessly over the baby's name. Even the royal easel erected on the forecourt of Buckingham Palace became an object of great fascination. When Prince George's arrival was finally announced on the big screen in New York City's Times Square, the cheers were resounding. "Am I missing something?" said Lionel Shriver in the New York Times. "Did we not cut our apron strings to the British monarchy emphatically and at some cost? Let the Brits celebrate. Anything to distract them from crippling austerity, waning influence, and increasingly diluted national identity. But the hoo-ha in the U.S. is mystifying. For some reason, many Americans seem to believe that Elizabeth II, her curmudgeonly son Charles, his strapping sons Will and Harry, and the winsome Duchess and her newborn belong to us." "Don't be such a killjoy," says Louise Branson in USAtoday.com. "After 237 years of independence, Americans had the best of both worlds. They get to enjoy the endlessly entertaining spectacle of the royal family, seen as real-life Downton Abbey characters, without having to pay taxes to support them or be crippled with guilt about how a democracy can still have a monarchy. Long live the royal soap opera, and long live the future king." A note on the third article. Last week I mispronounced the gentleman's name, Weiner, and unfortunately he actually pronounces it Weiner. The Weiner Scandal, Part 2. Anthony Weiner's campaign for mayor of New York City was on the verge of imploding this week after the Democrat acknowledged that he had continued to send sexually explicit messages online for months after resigning from Congress in disgrace. A 23-year-old woman claimed that Weiner had exchanged messages with her between July and November 2012, more than a year after he resigned over lewd photos sent to women online. Weiner used the pseudonym Carlos Danger in his exchanges with the woman, sending her graphic sexual messages and pictures of his genitals and inviting her to meet for sex. Winter did not deny the new claims, but said, "This behavior is behind me." His wife, Huma Abedin, former aide to Hillary Clinton, appeared at his side to say she had forgiven him. "Winter must drop out of the race," said New York Times in an editorial. When this tawdry saga began in 2011, the congressman accused his enemies of smearing him before he owned up. Now, we learn his sexual peccadilloes continue even as he gave interviews claiming to be a changed man and prepared to seek redemption by public office. This familiar but repellent pattern of misleading and evasion thoroughly disqualifies him from leading the city. "Why should we care?" said Tracy Clark Flory in Salon.com. "Wiener is no Puritan moralist. His hypocrisy is a deeply personal one. His extramarital sexting is a matter for him and Abedin, and doesn't reflect on his suitability for mayor. It proves only that he's an egocentric risk-taker. But are those not also qualities that might make him a good politician?" "This is far more than a little personal problem," said Michelle Cottle in thedailybeast.com. Wiener kept exposing himself online after he'd vaporized his political career and made himself a national laughingstock. That's the definition of an ungovernable impulse. The guy is sick. And with his persistent perviness, he's placed his private parts squarely on the ballot. Is that what New Yorkers want of their mayor? Moving on from the main stories, we'll now take a look at the controversy of the week. Headline, Obama on race. Quote, "Trayvon could have been me." The topic of race has always been dangerous territory for the first black president, said Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. So when Obama unexpectedly waded into the Trayvon Martin case last week, it was clear he had something urgent to say. Speaking candidly and without notes in the White House briefing room, Obama said he accepted the jury verdict that found Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman not guilty of any wrongdoing in his fatal shooting of the 17-year-old Martin. But then he addressed the frustration of the black community, saying its young men too often are painted with a broad brush as potential criminals. "Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago," said Obama, recounting his own experience of being followed in department stores, of hearing car locks click as he crossed the street, of seeing white women clutch their purses tighter when he stepped into an elevator. By so eloquently explaining his kinship with a buried black boy, said Charles Blow in the New York Times, the president gave voice to a people's pain. This divisive speech served only to pick the scab of America's healing wound, said Joseph Curl in the Washington Times. The Zimmerman trial hinged entirely on legal questions of self-defense and reasonable doubt. Obama, though, went out of his way to play the race card, contending that if Martin had been white, both the outcome and the aftermath might have been different. "The sad truth," said John O'Sullivan in NationalReview.com, "is that a young black man is 13 times more likely to be killed by another young black man than by a person of another race. It's also true that young black men cause a disproportionate amount of crime in this country." Too bad Obama glossed over these realities while indulging African Americans' delusion that the greatest threat facing them is murder at the hands of white racists. Obama addressed black-on-black crime head-on, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com, explicitly noting that young black men are statistically more likely to be shot by a peer than by people of other races. But he also asked white Americans to imagine how it feels to be an upstanding black man, perpetually deemed guilty just because of how you look. This was an appeal for mutual empathy. Too bad the knee-jerk right couldn't hear it. Talk, though, is cheap, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Where are Obama's policy proposals for addressing our country's persistent racial divide and the problems of young black men? He might start with teen pregnancy prevention, faith-based programs that reclaim lives from gangs, expanded substance abuse treatment, and prison reform, so that many young black men aren't locked up. Is there really nothing practical that can be done? Obama doesn't seem to think so, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. In his stirring speech on race back in 2008, he optimistically called on America to share the audacity of hope that we could heal our racial wounds and transcend our differences. But five brutal years have passed, and the president who revisited race last week betrayed a deep pessimism. African-American youths need help, he said. But we're not rolling out some five-point plan. He wearily noted that national conversations organized by politicians aren't particularly productive. In 2008, Obama seemed to believe that with the right leaders, America was ready to move forward on race. Last week, he said it might be up to his daughter's generation. The ones we are waiting for, Obama seems to be said, are still coming. And now on a shorter and perhaps lighter note, we'll take a look at the good week four, bad week four briefs. A good week four, skipping dessert. After the fabulously wealthy city of Dubai launched a campaign to get its increasingly chubby citizens to lose weight, saying it would reward dieters with a gram of gold for every kilogram, roughly 2.2 pounds they shed. A good week for rebranding. After the rapper Jay-Z announced that he was dropping the hyphen from his stage name and would henceforth be known as Jay-Z, without the hyphen, he didn't explain why. A good week for teamwork. After dozens of Tokyo commuters pushed a 32-ton train carriage away from the platform, freeing a woman who had fallen into the 8-inch gap between the train and the platform during the morning rush hour, the woman emerged unscathed. On the other hand, it was a bad week for Tiger Woods, who not only played badly in the final two rounds of the British Open, but was widely criticized for spitting all over the course. Somebody now has to come behind him and maybe putt over his spit, said British sportcaster Ewan Murray. A bad week for red tape. After the Department of Agriculture demanded that magicians who use rabbits in their acts submit plans on how they'd save the animals in a natural disaster, magician Gary Maurer said he would carry a note reading, "Take rabbit with you when you leave. That's my plan." And a bad week for making the boyfriend happy after a Russian woman was found naked outside of her apartment with her head stuck in a staircase handrail. She told police that she had been trying to spice things up with her boyfriend. The ungrateful cad fled the scene. As we move on to the briefing section, we have an international story with a local connection. It's called China's Buying Spree. China's purchase of America's biggest pork producer was just the latest of many U.S. acquisitions. What's the agenda? What has China bought? It's quite a portfolio. Chinese firms now own IBM's personal computer division, Volvo, purchased from Ford, the AMC movie theater chain, the Virginia-based pork producer Smithfield, as well as large stakes in Devon Energy and Chesapeake Energy, two of the biggest U.S. natural gas and oil companies. So far this year alone, Chinese companies have spent $10 billion on U.S. deals, compared with less than $1 billion in all of 2008. That doesn't yet put China among the top 10 nations for foreign direct investment in the U.S., but the trend is steep, and China's buying potential is enormous. After decades of sitting on the massive sums earned by flooding U.S. and European markets with its products, China is flush with cash and is now eager to spend it. Why the lust for foreign companies? With more than a billion people, China has a chronic need for raw materials and energy. Many of its acquisitions are in those industries, such as Canadian energy giant Nexen, oil and gas pipelines in Central Asia, and mineral mines in Australia and Africa. But the growing Chinese middle class also has a fondness for French wine, so the Chinese investors have been snapping up vineyards in Bordeaux. Pork is China's most popular meat, and the country hasn't been able to meet domestic demand since 2008. Hence, a Chinese meat producer's recent $4.7 billion purchase of Smithfield, the world's biggest pork producer. In that case, the Chinese company was also buying some public trust among Chinese consumers, since the country's own food industry is so scandal-ridden. This year, rat meat was discovered being sold as lamb. Acquiring foreign companies also gives China a quick infusion of badly needed technological know-how. Does the U.S. government object? Washington blocks sales when it considers national security to be at risk. The Obama administration last year denied a Chinese-owned company permission to build wind turbines in Oregon on a site deemed too close to a U.S. naval base. This year, Chinese telecom giant Huawei was barred from buying any U.S. telecom companies after a congressional report noted that the Chinese military could use such assets for malicious purposes. China's biggest failed takeover attempt came in 2005, when loud squawks from Congress convinced Unocal shareholders not to sell out to China's national oil company and instead accept Chevron's bid for $1.4 billion less. But individual states are less parochial. State governments all want the Chinese investment because they need jobs, said Siva Yam of the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce. They welcome them with open arms. Does investment go both ways? Not to the same extent. Some legislators objected to China's acquisition of Smithfield on the grounds that no U.S. company would be allowed to buy a major Chinese producer. In industries like mining, power generation, and transportation, the Chinese government selects national champions and effectively shuts out foreign competition altogether, says U.S. Ambassador Gary Locke. China restricts foreign ownership in more than 100 sectors, and when it does allow foreign investments, it generally requires that they be made in joint ventures that allow Chinese firms access to trade secrets. Japan's Kawasaki, for example, says that China is using its technology to make high-speed trains for export when it was supposed to limit production to the domestic rail industry. Where else is China investing? China has endeared itself to African, Latin American, and Asian countries with poor human rights records because it doesn't attach any political or labor conditions to its investments. But many developing countries are now rethinking their deals because their economies aren't benefiting as much as they hoped. China has a reputation for bringing its own workers, for example, rather than employing locals. To build a stadium in Angola in 2010, a Chinese firm hired 700 Chinese workers and just 250 Angolans. In Ghana, there are thousands of Chinese workers mining gold. How are these purchases changing China? Step by step, China's economy is becoming more integrated with the world's. U.S. lawmakers and labor groups have long complained that Beijing keeps the value of its currency, yuan or renminbi, artificially low in order to make Chinese exports cheaper. But at last month's annual bilateral economic talks, China committed to moving its currency toward a market rate. The decision isn't entirely altruistic. It will help China reorient some production toward the domestic market, benefiting its middle class. Meanwhile, the U.S. has been negotiating with other Asian countries to form a free trade pact, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China originally saw that as an attempt by the U.S. to push into its neighborhood, but now China says it might want to join. That could require it to put stricter controls on state-owned enterprises, open up its government procurement policies, and protect intellectual property rights. But it's not clear how far Chinese companies will be able or willing to go down that road, says Patricia Adams, head of Probe International, a foreign investment watchdog group. Their first priority is to their political masters, she said, and their political masters have a political agenda, not a business agenda. Next, we take a look at the best columns of the U.S. The first comes from Andrew Puzder of the Wall Street Journal. The biggest threat to Obamacare. As a CEO who employs 21,000 people, says Andrew Puzder, I've seen evidence that Obamacare may be headed for a cliff. At Carl's Jr. and Hardee's restaurants, we already offer employees various forms of health insurance. Yet only 6% of our crew-level workers sign up. They generally are in their 20s, so they don't worry about getting sick or injured, and they don't want to pay premiums for health care they don't believe they'll need. The Affordable Care Act hopes to compel younger Americans like my workers to buy health insurance by imposing penalties if they fail to sign up. But the annual penalties, ranging from $115 for low-paid workers to $1,250 for middle-income workers, will still be cheaper than the cost of buying health insurance. If millions of young, uninsured Americans do the math and defy Obamacare's individual mandate, it'll be a disaster. There won't be enough young, healthy people in the insurance exchanges to offset the cost of sick or high-risk individuals, sending premiums soaring. Why, again, did the president saddle the country with this complicated mess? The second column, Honoring Traitors to the U.S. by Stephen I. Weiss of The Atlantic. Should the U.S. government honor the dead soldiers of the Confederacy? Asked Stephen I. Weiss. Few people know that the federal government has paid $2 million to provide 18,593 headstones for rebel soldiers over the past decade, usually at the request of such heritage groups as the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. Many of these groups promote a nostalgic sympathy for the Confederacy that most Americans would find shocking, including the belief that the South was right to secede. In a recent newsletter, one leader of the SCV defended segregation, stating that Southerners had rightfully objected to legal and social equality for all. Incredibly, taxpayers are helping these groups erect gravestones and memorials, some of which contain defiant inscriptions implying that the South's cause was just. The truth is that their fallen heroes were traitors to the United States who killed hundreds of thousands of American soldiers in order to preserve slavery. So why is our federal government now obliged to honor them? Why not require Southern states, at least, to pay the bills? Some Southerners, sadly, are still fighting the Civil War, and using federal tax dollars to encourage their racist nostalgia should be beyond the pale. And finally, The Doctor Isn't Always Right by Tracy Weber and Charles Ornstein from ProPublica.org. When your doctor prescribes you a drug, said Tracy Weber and Charles Ornstein, how do you know he's picked the right one? Every doctor can choose from among hundreds of available drugs, and those choices may be dictated by whim, undue big pharma influence, or even ignorance of the latest information. Some doctors may prescribe a particular blood pressure drug, for example, because they receive gifts or payments from drug companies, and consistently favor expensive brand name medicine over cheaper generics. A staff doctor at a local nursing home may regularly prescribe antipsychotics to sedate patients suffering from dementia, despite a black box warning that these drugs increase the risk of death in such patients. Yet patients have no way of knowing of such practices. When we recently filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Medicare for doctors' prescription histories, the results were disturbing. We found some doctors repeatedly violating standard protocols and prescribing, for example, Alzheimer's drugs to people with autism. For the public's safety, the prescribing history of all doctors should be available on a searchable database. What we don't know can hurt us. Turning now to the last word section, we have the headline, Bringing Extinct Species Back to Life. Scientists are close to reaching a long-held goal, says Carl Zimmer. Are they playing God? On July 30, 2003, a team of Spanish and French scientists reversed time. They brought an animal back from extinction, if only to watch it become extinct again. The animal they revived was a kind of wild goat known as a bucardo, or Pyrenean ibex. The bucardo was a large, handsome creature, reaching up to 220 pounds and sporting long, gently curved horns. For thousands of years, it lived high in the Pyrenees, where it clambered along cliffs, nibbling on leaves and stems and enduring harsh winters. Then came the guns. Hunters drove down the bucardo population over several centuries. In 1989, there were only a dozen or so individuals left. 10 years later, a single bucardo remained, a female nicknamed Celia. A team led by wildlife veterinarian Alberto Fernandez Arias caught the animal in a trap, clipped a radio collar around her neck, and released her back into the wild. 9 months later, the collar let out a long, steady beep, the signal that Celia had died. With her death, the bucardo became officially extinct. But Celia's cells lived on, preserved in labs. Over the next few years, a team of reproductive physiologists injected nuclei from those cells into goat eggs emptied of their own DNA, then implanted the eggs in surrogate mothers. After 57 implantations, only 7 animals had become pregnant. And of those 7 pregnancies, 6 ended in miscarriages. One mother, a hybrid between a Spanish ibex and a goat, carried a clone of Celia to term. But after a mere 10 minutes, Celia's clone died. A necropsy later revealed that one of her lungs had grown a gigantic extra lobe as solid as a piece of liver. The dodo and the great auk, the thylacine and the Chinese river dolphin, the passenger pigeon and the imperial woodpecker. The bucardo is only one in a long list of animals humans have driven extinct, sometimes deliberately. And with many more species now endangered, the bucardo will have much more company in the years to come. Fernandez Arias belongs to a small group of researchers who believe that cloning can help reverse that trend. The notion of bringing vanished species back to life, some call it de-extinction, has hovered at the boundary between reality and science fiction for more than 2 decades, ever since novelist Michael Crichton unleashed the dinosaurs of Jurassic Park on the world. For most of that time, the science of de-extinction has lagged far behind the fantasy. Celia's clone is the closest that anyone has gotten to true de-extinction. Fernandez Arias has been waiting for the moment when science would finally catch up, and humans might gain the ability to bring back an animal they had driven extinct. "We are at that moment," he told me. "It's gone very much further, very much more rapidly than anyone ever would have imagined," said Ross McAfee of the American Museum of Natural History. "What we really need to think about is why we would want to do this in the first place, to actually bring back a species." In Jurassic Park, dinosaurs are resurrected for their entertainment value. In reality, the only species we can hope to revive now are those that died within the past few tens of thousands of years and left behind remains that harbor intact cells or, at the very least, enough ancient DNA to reconstruct this creature's genome. Because of the natural rates of decay, we can never hope to retrieve the full genome of Tyrannosaurus rex, which vanished about 65 million years ago. The species theoretically capable of being revived all disappeared while humanity was rapidly climbing toward world domination. If we're talking about species we drove extinct, then I think we have an obligation to try to do this, says paleontologist Michael Archer. Some people protest that reviving a species that no longer exists amounts to playing God. Archer scoffs at the notion. "I think we played God when we exterminated those animals." Other scientists who favor de-extinction argue that there will be concrete benefits. Biological diversity is a storehouse of natural invention. Most pharmaceutical drugs, for example, were not invented from scratch. They were derived from natural compounds found in wild plant species, which are also vulnerable to extinction. Some extinct animals also performed vital services in their ecosystems, which might benefit from their return. Siberia, for example, was home 12,000 years ago to mammoths and other big grazing mammals. Back then, the landscape was not moss-dominated tundra, but grassy steppes. Sergei Zimov, a Russian ecologist, has long argued that this was no coincidence. The mammoths and numerous herbivores maintained the grassland by breaking up the soil and fertilizing it with their manure. Once they were gone, moss took over and transformed the grassland into a less productive tundra. When Fernandez Arias first tried to bring back the Bucardo 10 years ago, the tools at his disposal were, in hindsight, woefully crude. In those early days, scientists would clone an animal by taking one of its cells and inserting its DNA into an egg that had been emptied of its own genetic material. An electric shock was enough to get the egg to start dividing, after which the scientists would place the developing embryo in a surrogate mother. The vast majority of those pregnancies failed, and the few animals that were born were often beset with health problems. Over the past decade, scientists have improved their success with cloning animals, shifting the technology from high-risk science to workaday business. Researchers have also developed the ability to induce animal cells to return to embryo-like state. They can be coaxed to develop into any type of cell, including eggs or sperm. The eggs can then be further manipulated to develop into full-fledged embryos. Such technical sleights of hand make it far easier to conjure a vanished species back to life. Scientists and explorers have been talking for decades about bringing back the mammoth. Now, armed with the new cloning technologies, researchers at the Suom Biotech Research Foundation in Seoul have teamed up with Russian mammoth experts. Last summer, they found frozen chunks of mammoth tissue, including bone marrow, hair, skin, and fat. The tissue is now in Seoul, where the Suom scientists are examining it. If the Suom researchers find a viable cell, they could coax it to produce millions of cells. These could be reprogrammed to grow into embryos, which could then be implanted in elephants, the mammoth's closest living relatives. In 1813, while traveling along the Ohio River in Kentucky, John James Audubon witnessed one of the most miraculous natural phenomena of his time, a flock of passenger pigeons blanketing the sky. The air was literally filled with pigeons, he later wrote. The light of noonday was obscured as by an eclipse. The dung fell in spots, not unlike melting flakes of snow. And the continued buzz of wings had a tendency to lull my senses to repose. When Audubon reached Louisville, the pigeons were still passing overhead and continued to do so for the next 3 days. The people were all in arms, wrote Audubon. The banks of the Ohio were crowded with men and boys, incessantly shooting at the pilgrims. Multitudes were thus destroyed. In 1813, it would have been hard to imagine a species less likely to become extinct. Yet by the end of the century, the red-breasted passenger pigeon was in catastrophic decline. The forest it depended on shrinking, and its numbers dwindling from relentless hunting. In 1900, the last confirmed wild bird was shot by a boy with a BB gun. 14 years later, the one remaining captive passenger pigeon died at the Cincinnati Zoo. The writer and environmentalist Stuart Brand grew up in Illinois hiking in forests that just a few decades before had been aroar with the sound of passenger pigeons' wings. Its habitat was my habitat, he says. 2 years ago, Brand and his wife, Ryan Phelan, founder of the genetic testing company DNA Direct, began to wonder if it might be possible to bring the species back to life. One night over dinner with Harvard biologist George Church, they discovered that he was thinking along the same lines. Church knew that standard cloning methods wouldn't work, since bird embryos developed inside shells and no museum specimen of the passenger pigeon would likely contain a fully intact functional genome. But preserved specimens contain fragments of DNA. By piecing together fragments, scientists can now read the roughly 1 billion letters of the passenger pigeon genome. Church can't yet synthesize an entire animal genome from scratch, but he has invented technology that allows him to make sizable chunks of DNA of any sequence he wants. He could theoretically manufacture genes for passenger pigeon traits, a gene for its long tail, for example, and splice them into the genome of a stem cell from a common rock pigeon. Rock pigeon stem cells containing this doctor genome could be transformed into germ cells, the precursors to eggs and sperm. These could then be injected into rock pigeon eggs. Squabs hatched from these eggs would look like normal rock pigeons, but they would be carrying doctored DNA. When the squabs reached maturity and mated, their eggs would hatch squabs carrying the unique passenger pigeon traits. These birds could then be further interbred, the scientists selecting for birds that were more and more like the vantage species. Church's genome retooling method could theoretically work on any species with a close living relative and a genome capable of being reconstructed. So even if the SUAM team fails to find an intact mammoth nucleus, someone might still bring the species back. Scientists already have the technology for reconstructing most of the genes it takes to make a mammoth, which could be inserted into an elephant stem cell. And there is no shortage of raw material for further experiments emerging from the Siberian permafrost. With mammoths, it's really a dime a dozen up there, says Hendrik Poyner, an expert on mammoth DNA. It's just a matter of finances now. Even if de-extinction proved a complete logistical success, the questions would not end. Passenger pigeons might find the rebounding forest of the eastern United States a welcoming home. But wouldn't that be, in effect, the introduction of a genetically engineered organism into the environment? Could passenger pigeons become a reservoir for virus that might wipe out another bird species? And how would the residents of Chicago, New York, or Washington, D.C. feel about new pigeon species arriving in their cities, darkening the skies and covering their streets with snowstorms of dung? De-extinction advocates are pondering these questions, and most believe they need to be resolved before any major project moves forward. Hank Greeley, a leading bioethicist, has taken a keen interest in investigating the ethical and legal implications of de-extinction. And yet, for Greeley, as for many others, the very fact that science has advanced to the point that such a spectacular feat is possible is a compelling reason to embrace de-extinction, not to shun it. What intrigues me is just that it's really cool, Greeley says. A saber-toothed cat? It would be neat to see one of those. This article comes to us from Carl Zimmer, National Geographic Creative. Turning now to the health and science section, we start with an article titled, Why Dementia Rates Are Declining. The odds that an individual develop Alzheimer's or dementia are falling, new research suggests. Even though the number of U.S. cases is predicted to triple by 2050 as the huge baby boomer generation ages. One large study in England and Wales found that dementia rates have dropped 25% over the past two decades, a trend that epidemiologists say likely holds true in other developed countries too. Another study, this one in Denmark, found that people reaching their 90s now are mentally sharper than those who turned 90 a decade ago, suggesting that more people are living to older ages with better overall functioning, University of Southern Denmark epidemiologist Kjær Christensen tells BBCnews.com. Researchers believe that the mental condition of the elderly has improved because more people are going to school longer than in generations past, and education seems to help protect against cognitive decline. More people are also receiving treatment for high blood pressure and cholesterol, causing few of them to suffer from dementia caused by small strokes. Aging is malleable, says Marcel Olde Rickert of Radboud University in the Netherlands. People, their lifestyles, and their environments can contribute a lot to the way they age. The second article asks the question, when to cut the cord? Newborns, whose doctors cut their umbilical cords right after birth, may be missing out on major health benefits. That's the finding of researchers who gathered data on nearly 4,000 mother and baby pairs and compared outcomes of those whose umbilical cords were clamped right away with those whose cords were clamped more than a minute after birth. Standard medical practice is to cut the cord immediately after an infant is born, a measure thought to reduce the risk of maternal hemorrhaging. But the study found that babies whose cord cutting was delayed by at least a minute had higher levels of vital blood protein, hemoglobin, than babies whose cords were snipped right away. They were also less likely to develop an iron deficiency, and they had higher birth weights thanks to the added infusion of blood traveling through the cord after birth. The study found no evidence that mothers suffer any ill effects from delayed clamping. We are talking about depriving babies of 30 to 40% of their blood at birth. And just because we've learned a practice that's bad, Eileen Hutton, a professor of obstetrics at McMaster University in Ontario, tells the New York Times. The healthcare scare of the week, omega-3 and prostate cancer. The omega-3 fatty acids found in fish have long been credited with reducing inflammation and helping to protect against heart disease and Alzheimer's. But a new study by the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle shows that men who consume high levels of omega-3s in fish or fish oil supplements have a 43% increased risk of developing prostate cancer compared with those who consume low levels. They are also 71% more likely to develop high-grade prostate cancer, the type most likely to be fatal. Fish oil is the most popular supplement in the U.S., but there is really no evidence that taking dietary supplements is beneficial to health, and there is increasing evidence that taking high doses is harmful, the study authors write. It's unclear why omega-3s from fish might increase the risk of prostate cancer. Fatty acids found in vegetable oils and flax seeds do not. The findings don't mean that men should stop eating fish, study co-author Theodore Brasky tells ABCNews.com, but they should probably moderate their intake of fatty fish, and they should avoid fish oil supplements. And we wind down our hour today in the Talking Points section with an article titled, Liz Cheney, A Surprising Senate Challenge. Darth Vader has a daughter, and she's running for the Senate, said Michelle Cottle in thedailybeast.com. Liz Cheney, the offspring of bloodthirsty overlord and former Vice President Dick Cheney, announced last week that she will mount a primary challenge to fellow Republican Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming in next year's primary. Enzi is one of the most conservative members of the Senate, anti-abortion, pro-gun, and anti-gay marriage. But that still puts him to the left of Liz, a woman who remains 100% convinced that her dad was 100% right 100% of the time. Invading Iraq? Great idea. Torture? A no-brainer. Is Obama a terrorist-appeasing wimp who's betrayed his own country? Righto. Liz's attacks on Obama and anyone who disagrees with her neocon views have been so unhinged that many Republicans are expressing open horror that she's running. It's a disaster, said former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson. Quite the opposite, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Enzi's a tried member of the Republican old guard, a lackluster 69-year-old who has been occupying the seat for three terms without exactly covering himself with glory. If he disappeared from the Senate, no one would even notice. Cheney, meanwhile, is widely acknowledged to be one of the party's brightest stars. Enzi's big flaw is that he's too chummy with Republican leaders like Senator Mitch McConnell, said Eric Erickson in redstate.com. As a result, he supports the farm bill, the post office bailout, and other big spending measures favored by the GOP establishment. We need more combative figures like Senator Ted Cruz, who use their visibility to put points on the board for conservatives. Liz Cheney has the same kind of guts. Wyoming Republicans don't share that enthusiasm, said Peter Greer in CSMonitor.com. In the first poll of likely primary voters, Enzi walloped Cheney 55-21. She's being seen for the carpetbagger she is. Though born in Wisconsin, Cheney has spent most of her adult life in Washington, D.C., and suburban Virginia, and only bought a house in touristy Jackson Hole last year. Democrats, however, are very supportive of Cheney's decision to run, said Gail Collins in the New York Times. Nothing makes Democrats happier than seeing the opposition torn apart by a primary featuring scary right-wing candidates. It's even better if the scary candidate's name is Cheney, and her seething belligerence reminds the nation of how we came to have a war in Iraq. Syria? Yes, it could get even worse. Is it too late for us to do something about Syria? Said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Congressional Intelligence Committees belatedly approved President Obama's plan to send weapons to the Syrian opposition this week. But those shipments of small arms will not substantially affect an ongoing humanitarian catastrophe, which has taken nearly 100,000 lives and forced 1.7 million Syrians to flee the country. The conflict is no longer a simple civil war between dictatorial President Bashar al-Assad and rebel forces, but a regional sectarian struggle between Hezbollah, the Shiite extremist group that is fighting for Assad, and Sunni affiliates of al-Qaeda who are trying to oust Assad. In recent weeks, Assad has reversed the war's momentum, said Ben Hubbard in the New York Times. The rival rebel groups have turned on each other and are battling over turf with increasing ferocity. Meanwhile, the dictator has carved out what amounts to a rump state in central Syria, with firm control over Damascus and cities in the country's north. That's all the more reason to act now, said Anthea H. Cordesman in the Washington Post. If Assad clings to power, Syria's civil war could lead to a major conflict between Sunnis and Shiites throughout the Muslim world. Dividing Lebanon, threatening Turkey, destabilizing Iraq, and empowering Iran. To tip the balance back to the rebels, the U.S. should convince its allies to help fund and create a no-fly zone over all of Syria. That's unlikely to happen, said Gordon Lubold in foreignpolicy.com. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, testified this week that establishing a no-fly zone would cost up to $1 billion a month and could easily slip the U.S. into another new war. Interventionists like Senator John McCain are clamoring for Obama to do something. But the reality is that every military option in Syria sucks. A brief poll watch. Overall, 41% of Americans approve of the not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman, while 41% disapprove. 51% of white Americans support the verdict, while 86% of African Americans disagree with it. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Carolyn and Charlie Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.